from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Cambridge police say a police officer acted properly in an encounter that was videotaped.
You have no reason to keep your hands on me.
You're being detained by the police.
Also today, our conversations with the Massachusetts congressional delegation about the presidential election. And the outgoing White House drug czar says he's optimistic the Trump administration will continue President Obama's policies on opioids.
We have 78 people dying every single day of an opioid overdose, and I think that warrants a compassionate, humane response.
Plus,
Julia Child presents the Chicken Sisters, Miss Broiler, Miss Fryer.
Julia Child's great-nephew on how she became an American TV icon.
We're roasting Miss Chicken today on The French Chef.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We begin today with the controversial video of an encounter in Cambridge last month between an on-duty, plainclothed police officer and a pedestrian. Cambridge police today say that after an internal review of that incident, the police officer's actions have been found to have been consistent with his duty obligations. The video was shot by a bystander. It shows Cambridge Detective Sergeant Thomas Ahern holding Cleon Hodge of Dorchester by the sweatshirt while a small crowd gathers.
Yeah, you started this.
And you're not.
No,
you
didn't do anything.
Get away from me. You're going to be under arrest in 2 seconds. Get away.
For what?
Leave it alone.
Cambridge police are looking into charging Hodge and two bystanders, saying that Hodge made eye contact with Sergeant Ahern before intentionally walking into him in Porter Square. Well, joining us to talk about this is Michael Sherling. He's former chief of the Burlington, Vermont Police Department. He's also an executive fellow for the Police Foundation in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So what did you think when you saw this video?
Well, the video, the portion that is portrayed in the video is a little bit ambiguous. It certainly looks from the portions that are available like both parties are relatively calm in the face of whatever transpired in the street. And, you know, one of the things that is compelling through the lens of police officers that are operating in the street is that when bystanders get directly involved without necessarily knowing the totality of what's happened, that can be a distraction that actually inhibits the ability to sort out what the right course of action is.
So from your vantage...
That's not to say that having bystanders videotape what happens and be good witnesses and stand by and watch the encounter is not at all a problem. That's something that I think we expect to occur.
But you think in this particular case, from your vantage point, the bystanders here may have exacerbated the situation?
They may have. Again, it is difficult to know exactly what's going on through just the lens of a cell phone camera. So it's hard to know with any certainty, but that certainly complicates what is already a complicated scenario when you're dealing with a street-level encounter.
Now, as we said, Sergeant Ahern is plainclothed officer on duty, and he does identify himself as an officer. Let's listen to another piece of that tape from that video.
What are you doing? Why are you pulling him over?
Can you get your hands off me? He's supposed to say excuse me.
What?
He's supposed to say excuse me when you cross the street.
What do you do? He's not doing anything.
He's supposed to say excuse me when you cross the street.
Police, back off. Back up. Police.
Think?
I hope this makes sense.
Back off, police. What?
So, Michael Sherling, I'm just wondering, is there different training for folks in telling police officers when they are plainclothed? How do they interact with the public?
Well, one of the most important things is to immediately identify yourself and to show some form of identification. And, you know, it is dependent on the circumstances. In some cases, it's much better for a police officer in plain clothes, whether they're on or off duty, to be a good witness to something. In other cases, it makes sense to intervene. And, you know, in most cases, when you're on duty, regardless of whether you're in uniform or you're in plain clothes, there is an inherent duty to act, to intervene if something is amiss.
Now, Sergeant Ahern at one point throws a woman's phone onto the ground as she's filming, and he does say that it was almost hitting him in the face as she was filming. I'm wondering about that particular encounter there. And now one of the women involved, I guess, who touched Sergeant Ahern while she was asking him questions, and he did identify himself as a police officer, may be charged with assault and battery on a police officer as well. Those are the charges that are under consideration in the criminal complaint. It seems like things got out of hand rather quickly here.
It does. And
are you there?
Can you hear me?
Now we can. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Okay. You heard in the last clip that you played, the bystander is challenging the officer roadside. And, I think one of the most important things to learn from this lesson and many others that are playing out around the nation is certainly if you see something that you think is amiss, between a police officer and a member of the public, be a good witness, videotape it if you'd like. Do that from a little bit of a distance, though, because there's a lot going on in the officer's mind in terms of keeping themselves safe. They also have a duty to keep the person that they're interacting with safe, and it gets incredibly complicated really fast. So making that overt challenge to the officer roadside, I would argue, is not the right time to do that.
But what about slapping the phone from her hands?
That's a portion that I didn't see in my quick review of the video. So, I think it depends on the circumstances. That very well may be something that's that we would consider to be out of bounds under certain circumstances. But if the phone is directly up in the officer's face, it may just be a reaction to try to get somebody to step back. So, what we don't know all of the details around this. We just have the fragments of video that are available. So there's always more information that needs to be taken into account as you make those determinations, whether an officer was compliant with policy and the legal standards of detaining people, and then what happens in the steps that follow that.
Right. I want to get into some of those legal standards. I mean, what was the probable cause here to even ask this man what was in his pocket or for his ID?
So that's a great question. What we see most often from folks' understanding of what happens on television is you have to have a threshold of probable cause in order for an officer to take some kind of official action. And the reality is that it's actually a lesser standard of reasonable suspicion, which simply means that you have facts and circumstances that would lead someone to believe that more investigation is required. The courts have sometimes actually referred to this as more than a hunch, but less than probable cause, a fairly ambiguous standard by which officers can intervene to determine whether a crime's been committed or to dispel that suspicion. So,
but what would have been the crime here?
Well, as described, it's not entirely clear from the news accounts. So there is a description of an interaction that occurs in the street where two people bump into each other. Now, there's a wide array of what could have happened there. It could be as innocent as someone not paying attention and bumping into each other, or it could have been something more aggressive than that. And I don't have enough information to judge which end of the spectrum or whether it's in the middle of that spectrum. But as an extension of what the officer chose to do next, the officer at least believes that it was something more aggressive than just an innocent bumping in the street.
I want to just ask you about take up something that's related to that point. There's a report that was written by Sergeant Ahern where he says that as the bystanders gathered, he says, quote, as this was occurring, I could see that his hands, his meaning Hodges' hands, were clenched into fists, which I interpreted as a pre-assault cue. Now, are officers trained to look for that and consider that a pre-assault cue and take action?
They are. Whenever a police officer is interacting with somebody, even if it's at a very low level, unfortunately, it's most often viewed as an adversarial kind of interaction, although they don't always have to be. And that causes people's fight or flight reflex to often kick in. And one of the things that's important to keep people safe, keep officers safe, but also the people they're interacting with safe, or others that may be at the scene, because oftentimes you're trying to diffuse situations that involve multiple parties, is to look for that technical term of pre-assaultive cues. I think you can separate the technical term from what most people would view as aggressive behavior. You know, most folks have a sort of sixth sense when they see someone who's about to act aggressively or that they are about to get into an altercation. They can see the components of that happen. And one of those things, as the officer described, is a clenching of fists, a changing in breathing behaviors, the nature of eye contact, and oftentimes it's statements that are made by someone who's about to be aggressive.
Now, the big thing here now are these charges, assault and battery against the pedestrian here, and then assault and battery, as we said, against a police officer, a serious charge against one of the bystanders here, and that, of course, carries up to a 2.5-year prison sentence. Why, if you're an officer and you've de-escalated the situation, because the charges weren't filed until after this happened, why file these charges? There are many folks, if you read some of the comments on the article here, who are saying, you know, why are we spending all of our taxpayer dollars on litigating this case now in court?
Well, that comes down to the community standard for when charges are brought. And one of the unique things to the justice system in the United States is that there are many different jurisdictions and things happen differently in each of those jurisdictions. That's both an advantage because we have more custom justice systems in each of our states and municipalities. It's also a disadvantage in that you oftentimes can receive a different kind of penalty or a different kind of charge depending on where it is. And that's a really long way of saying I'm not an expert in Massachusetts law or the operational nature of what happens in that area of Mass. So it sort of depends on the jurisdiction.
Okay, but based on what you've seen, assault and battery against a police officer, you know, is a serious charge. You know that having that on someone's record is going to, you know, haunt them for a very long time and follow them for a very long time. From what you've seen in this video, is that incident worth those kinds of charges?
Again, I would hesitate to make a determination of that based on the video alone, but I think it's also important to note that the legal frameworks that police departments and prosecutors work in are limited. There's not always a good fit to a particular charge given the totality of the circumstance. So oftentimes the charging happens based on what the actions of the defendant most closely resemble, and then through the prosecution there is latitude to make modifications to that in order to achieve justice, to ensure that someone's not overcharged or undercharged or is subject to a penalty that isn't appropriate given the circumstances.
Michael Sherling, former chief of the Burlington, Vermont Police Department and an executive fellow for the Police Foundation in Washington, D.C., thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We want to turn now to those criminal charges that are being considered against the three folks involved in this incident. And joining us to talk about that is Howard Friedman. He's a Boston-based civil rights attorney who specializes in police officer conduct. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So first off, I'm not sure how much you heard of our conversation with Michael Sherling, but I'm wondering, what is your initial reaction to what he said regarding the potential charges against the three people involved here?
I think that they ultimately ended this incident the right way, which is no one was in handcuffs, they got their names, and they left. There was no need to go any further. The way it looks to me, the police sergeant decided that he would seek criminal charges. It's going to go to a clerk's hearing. The clerk is supposed to determine probable cause. If the clerk were to issue charges, and I don't think the clerk necessarily should, then it goes to a judge. And it is unlikely that these are going to end up in convictions. It's kind of a waste, I think, of the court's time. It's a good thing other officers got there. Everything, the situation was de-escalated. And by bringing charges, they are re-escalating it. It's not needed.
What's your reaction today to Cambridge Police saying that they feel that after an internal investigation, Sergeant Ahern acted appropriately in this case?
Well, I think that he overreacted when he says, well, gee, somebody was, he was looking at me when he bumped into me. And of course, what happens is police officers, when they're in plain clothes, assume everyone knows they're police officers because the bad guys do. But most of us aren't bad guys. Somebody bumps into him. It happens to us all as we walk down the streets in cities. And whether he looked, didn't look, it was no big deal. Nothing happened, no injury. And if he wasn't a police officer, if it was you or I, you just walk on. So he shouldn't have made it into the situation he did. He endangered himself and others, I think, in doing so. Once things calm down, it just makes sense to, you know, leave it alone at that point. But I think that the sergeant overreacted. It's not the most serious situation I've seen by a long shot. Fortunately, there was no force used. Nobody was injured. So perhaps they don't want to admit that he might have just overreacted. To me, this is the sort of thing where you might either just give him a counseling session or put some letter in his file, depending, of course, on the officer's prior history. But to say this is the way we would like to see our police sergeants act, that I think is wrong.
You know, many folks probably recall the controversial video of a Boston police officer earlier this year when you mentioned other incidents. In that particular case, the officer appeared to tackle a man after the man tapped on the officer's car with an umbrella. I don't know if you remember this incident, Attorney Friedman. Okay. So the police investigated for a couple of months, and then they said, actually, the man there had tripped. The officer didn't tackle him, and the officer pushed his knee into the man's back because that's what police are taught to do at the police academy. What did you think of how that investigation wrapped up and described that incident?
Well, you know, I didn't agree with the result of that investigation. And just in general, you know, as a lawyer, they have a saying, if you represent yourself, you're a fool for a client. And police officers, if they're involved in an incident where police need to be called, better to call the police who are active and on duty than to take a front because somebody tapped on your windshield with their umbrella and chase them down. You are personally involved. The reason that lawyers shouldn't represent themselves is they'd be personally involved. The same with police. Call the on-duty police. Don't get involved in chasing a pedestrian. And if you're not in uniform, people are going to wonder what's happening. That's one reason why people were videotaping the incident in Cambridge. People seeing it don't know that that's a police officer. It's a guy dressed like a civilian.
Right. Now, one of the things that we had asked Michael Schorling about, which I'd like to ask you about as well, is the issue of probable cause here. Was there probable cause to ask, you know, Mr. Hodge to what was in his pockets, to produce ID? I mean, could that be an issue as this goes forward? Mr. Schorling said, you know, there's actually a lower level of suspicion here before an officer can act that's required. And he said, you know, an officer can ask a pedestrian or a defendant for identification and can search them because it's not necessarily probable cause, but reasonable suspicion that could lead an officer to believe that more investigation of that particular person is warranted.
Well, that's true. That would be a Terry stop. You can stop and question someone. But the real question here, the probable cause would be that it was an assault because they bumped into one another. And Sergeant Ahern would say, well, I know it was an assault because when he bumped into me, he was looking at me. And now you feel like you're talking to fourth graders. You know, he was looking at me. No, I wasn't. And it's just, it's not the sort of thing that we should be bringing into our criminal courts.
Could Sergeant Ahern himself be charged here for slapping the cell phone out of the bystander's hand?
That would be the most troubling thing that he did because, of course, you have a First Amendment right to record the police. And, you know, police officers don't like it, but they are being trained that you can't interfere with that. You can't knock the phone down. You can't step on the phone. You know, and that he wasn't. If he was touched by the phone, it didn't seem to be anything of any kind of serious nature. So it looks more like he's trying to prevent the person from recording him. That could be a First Amendment violation. That could be a lawsuit. Again, any assaulting on either side is really minor, not worth either side bringing criminal charges. I see serious cases of police misconduct where people are, you know, in the hospital. That didn't happen. The officer's not injured. The civilian's not injured. This is the one where you really think they should shake hands and say, sorry this happened. But they shouldn't be going to the criminal courts and trying to get criminal complaints on either side. So, you know, the camera person may be a little bit different, but on either side.
All right. Howard Friedman, a Boston-based civil rights attorney who specializes in police officer conduct. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Congressman Richard Neal on the incoming Trump administration. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. President-elect Donald Trump no longer wants to move forward with an investigation into his former Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton. A spokesperson for Trump told MSNBC today that by doing so, Trump is setting a tone for Republicans in Congress. Well, we've been checking in with members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation for their thoughts after the divisive presidential election. Today, we're joined by Democratic Congressman Richard Neal. He's dean of the delegation. He represents Massachusetts' first congressional district, which covers parts of western Massachusetts. Congressman Neal, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be with you, Deb.
So first off, let's get your reaction to today's news that President-elect Trump does not want to move forward with an investigation of Hillary Clinton, something that he promised during the election. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm pleased that the Trump administration has acknowledged that we don't live in a third world country. Where all of a sudden the victor in the campaign then decides to have the loser in the campaign imprisoned. And I thought that was another very bad moment during the course of the campaign, and I think it came on the heels of the chants that said, lock her up. Mm-hmm. And I must tell you, I think that in one sense, we're all relieved that this campaign is over, and I think that it did not lift our aspirations, that's for sure.
So overall, talk to me a little bit about what you're thinking now that this campaign is over and the election is over.
Well, Deb, one of the things that comes to mind immediately is that these campaigns go on too long. I think there's broad agreement. It drives the money chase and it drives the advertising chase. And it also builds more conflict into the system. And I think that the candidates then, after they've said things, for example, as you've described it, then all of a sudden announce 2 weeks after the campaign, well, that was never really on the agenda anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a troubling aspect when you consider that a campaign should be about forming a government and that there is a connection to the electioneering process. But part of it is, I think, to inspire people. And in this instance here, I think that we leave this campaign season without a lot of inspiration, that's for sure.
Well, I think Mr. Trump may have inspired a lot of people, obviously. There are a significant number of people who supported him, and they think that he's going to bring change.
Well, when you consider that half the American people, 46%, really didn't show up on Election Day, that's another consideration. And I think that one could pursue that argument by simply saying, well, in the state of Wisconsin, which Secretary Clinton lost by 27,000 votes, that the turnout in Milwaukee was down by 40,000 votes. So I have concluded that in a couple of the big states that the polling was within a margin of error, so I think there's some forgiveness that's granted there. But not to miss the point that these campaigns are so poisonous now at virtually every level. And then we ask the public to rally to us in terms of governance afterwards, and it becomes much more challenging.
But also, I just want to go back to the point, though, that some people were, in fact, inspired by Donald Trump and supported him. You know, many in your district. You know, although the state of Massachusetts ultimately supported Hillary Clinton in the election, it was, I think, 60-33%. We looked at some of the numbers in your district, and the vote was about 57% Clinton, 37% Trump. Now, still, obviously, way ahead for Hillary Clinton. But 37% for Donald Trump. And also, the top five communities in Massachusetts that favored Trump over Clinton are in your district. So what do those results say to you?
Which I can also contrast it with the fact that on the same day, 75% of those voters voted for me. And I think that that's fairly telling as well. I don't want to understate the role that the protest vote played in this campaign, because I think that would be a great disservice to the energy on the other side. But I also think that one of the things that happened during the course of this campaign was that there were a series of outrageous statements that were offered. And then if we simply say, well, I really didn't mean it, and I've been going through polling data, for example, that where many people that supported Donald Trump are now saying, well, they never believed that he was really going to build the wall and ask the Mexican government to pay for it.
Right.
And so I think that there is a series, that there's a certain degree of license that one gets in a campaign. Don't get me wrong. But there's also a moment, I think, to talk about the future, and to talk about some of the concrete things that one would do if they were to accede to the highest office in the land. And I think that in this instance, there were three debates. The issue of global warming never came up. There were three debates. The issue of real infrastructure investment really never came up. The worker participation rate in America, which is now at a post-war low, never came up. And for the first time in 30 years, productivity is not going to grow. That never came up. And I think that economic anxiety that was coursing through the system, and you'll hear my colleagues in the delegation, they would tell you that I talk about this stuff all of the time. And instead, we were talking about Nasty Woman and that we're going to impanel a special grand jury afterwards, mm-hmm. and we're going to have a special prosecutor. I just think that democracy pays a price for that in a representative arena.
Let's talk about Trump's transition team so far. He's proposed several appointments. Your thoughts in general. Can you make a general thought about some of his appointments?
I think that there is a certain degree of latitude that a president-elect is granted. I mean, he did win the election, so I think that there will be ample time through the hearing process and the vetting process when questions will be asked, and there will be an opportunity for those who require congressional consent to state their views in public. But I would go so far as to be critical of Steve Bannon's appointment, because I think he has flirted with intense racial statements and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the quest for public office, we sometimes surround ourselves with people that we bring to government afterwards. And I think the test case ought to be that they avoid those sort of charged moments, as Bannon did during the campaign.
Let's talk about potential appointments, because we have a Massachusetts connection here. Former Senator Scott Brown, who apparently is being considered to head Veterans Affairs. He met with Trump yesterday. What do you think about Senator
Brown? I think he's a worthy candidate, to quote Governor Baker. I think that he has a military record. I think that he served in the U.S. Senate. And I think that in this instance here, that if the vetting process doesn't come up with any questions, I would think that he'd be a fine candidate. Mm.
Another member of the Massachusetts delegation, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. One of her key issues recently has been promising to fight to keep the current structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's the agency she helped create 6 years ago. But a federal court recently ruled that the agency's structure is unconstitutional, and that kind of opens the way for all kinds of changes, which, of course, are uncertain under the new administration. What are your thoughts?
Well, I certainly support the Consumer Board, but I think you're very perceptive in the critique that you've just offered. And that is the argument against it, as I hear it, see it, it's really as to whether or not the executive can unilaterally transfer executive authority to an individual in an appointed capacity as opposed to an elected capacity that would have these sort of broad powers and not have to answer to congressional oversight. So I think that's really the issue. But at the same time, I think in the aftermath of what came out of the worst recession since the Great Depression, I think Senator Warren is correct on that issue. We need to maintain a Consumer Protection Board and have somebody serve as an overseer within the constitutional framework of responsibility.
You know, because of where you sit on congressional committees, there are some issues over which you're going to have direct involvement, issues that came up during the campaign and presumably will be part of the early days of the Trump administration, taxes and trade, right?
And infrastructure, because you have to figure out how to pay for it.
Right. And, of course, we talked about infrastructure yesterday. We've got a lot of criticism about President-elect Trump's position on infrastructure today. We don't have a lot of specifics on these on some of these proposals, but we do know, for instance, when it comes to taxes, that Trump has suggested things such as eliminating the estate tax and cutting taxes on the middle class. He's also suggested renegotiating NAFTA and getting out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, let's unpack those two issues a bit. Let's start with taxes. What do you think about what you know of President-elect Trump's tax plan?
Well, it strikes me as though I was reading the New York Times this morning, and Arthur Laffer was cheering for it on the front page of the Times. And I think that it takes us back to Jack Kemp's years of making the argument for what are called supply-side economics during the Reagan years. And the problem with the argument is that they have said for decades that tax cuts pay for themselves. And, Deb, there's really no evidence that supports that position. You really can't find a mainstream economist who would embrace that position as well. So let me just give you a quick synopsis of where I think that the parallel is. On January 20th of 2001, when George W. Bush took the oath, he was looking at a projected surplus from CBO of almost $5 trillion over 15 years. And granted, it's a projection. And we cut taxes by 2001 by $1.3 trillion. And we came back in 2003 and cut taxes by another trillion. So we had $2.3 trillion worth of tax cuts during the Bush years, and we fought two wars, and the deficits exploded. And I think that whether one is a supporter of President Reagan or not, you do have to come to the conclusion that while we doubled military spending in those years, and I was in Congress just as the president was leaving, that we doubled military spending and cut taxes. And I think that those are the kinds of issues that then get us into the soup in terms of long-term deficits and debt. So Clinton leaves 4 successive balanced budgets. And if you recall, Alan Greenspan was warning us against paying down the debt too quickly. Mm. So the clock in Times Square that used to chronicle the debt, that had been turned off. So I have this memory institutionally because I've been on the Ways and Means Committee for a long period of time. And I recall vividly these arguments as they played out. And the inducement to the tax cuts during the Bush years was supposed to be economic growth. It is, I think, clear to say that it was the slowest economic growth since Herbert Hoover was president. And I don't say this to you to sound as though I'm whiny, because I do think that you could perhaps consider some targeted middle-class tax cuts. Because the economy, regardless of what both sides say on this, it's really been representative of pretty slow growth. 1.8% to 2.0%. That does not create enough jobs to really break through the deficits.
Okay.
And recall that deficits are mounted as you have tax cuts, and then the recession adds to it because social spending is formulaic.
Okay, so I think we're going to be debating this for quite some time. Essentially what you're saying is we haven't really learned from history here when it comes to taxes and economic growth, and things might need to be rethought a little bit, and I'm sure we'll be able to talk about that another day. Is that okay, Congressman?
I'd be delighted to.
Okay, Congressman Richard Neal,
happy
Dean.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and all.
Oh, happy Thanksgiving
all
to you
best.
As well. Congressman Richard Neal, Dean of the Massachusetts Congressional Delegation, represents the state's first congressional district. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Stay with us. Coming up, Julia Child's great-nephew on how she became an American TV icon. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
This is our Native American bird that has become a French classic. They call it dinde rôti. So it's roast turkey today on the French Chef.
That, of course, is the voice of Julia Child, the iconic American chef, and that was from a 1971 episode of her PBS show, The French Chef. Child hosted a number of television shows. Some were even shot right in her kitchen in Cambridge. And while Child's story has often been described as one of a lot of passion and luck, she was also someone who, through determination and grit, reinvented herself later in life. Her great-nephew, Alex Prudhomme, writes about Child's second act, as he calls it, in the new book, The French Chef in America. Prudhomme is the co-author of Child's memoir, My Life in France, and he joins us from NPR New York this Thanksgiving week, which we want to talk about as well. Alex, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Deborah. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks so much. And listeners, we want to tell you that we want to hear from you as well. Did you learn about cooking from Julia Child? Do you have any memories of Julia Child that you'd like to share? Did you know her when she lived in Cambridge? And are there any Julia Child recipes that will make it onto your Thanksgiving dinner table or have in the past? You can call us with your recipes, with your thoughts, with your remembrances of Julia Child at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Alex, let's start with Julia Child's return from France to the U.S. Remind us of what it was like for them to return.
Well, Paul was in the Foreign Service, and he and Julia had lived in France and in Germany and in Norway in the 40s and 50s, which was at the time when television was just starting up. They retired in 1961 and moved to Cambridge, bought a big gray clapboard house behind Harvard Yard, and settled in. And the food landscape was a little scary. It was the land of meals in a can, iceberg lettuce, Jell-O with marshmallows. It was kind of scary. And Julia had, in the meantime, become this wonderful French cook and was eager to share her lessons.
Hmm. What was she like as a family member?
Well, the Julia that you saw on television was the Julia that I knew in real life, slightly amplified, I think, for television. But she was large, funny, strong-willed, full of opinions, and just great to be around. Even when it was just the two of us working together at the end of her life, we were joking back and forth and gossiping about movies and politics and culture.
So she was sort of a natural fit for what she did in a way.
Yeah, there was no model for what she did. She was not the first cook on television by any means, but there was no one who had become a celebrity chef in the way that she had. And so she really operated by gut instinct, if you will, just kind of making her career up as she went along. And in many ways, you know, she was a revolutionary and a pioneer. And did things that no one had done before and anticipated a lot of what's happening today by decades.
What do you think she'd make of, I'm sure people ask you this, what do you think she'd make of this whole celebrity chef, chef competition, Iron Chef, oh my gosh, I can't even keep track of all of them, TV shows now about cooking. What do you think she would think?
I think she'd have a big laugh. I think she, on the one hand, I think she would be frustrated and disappointed because, you know, for her, she called cooking a civilized art, and she loved it for its camaraderie and its creativity, not for the kind of faux competitions and soap opera melodramas that you see on TV now. But on the other hand, this 24/7 culinary circus we have has inspired so many people, and it's brought a whole new generation or several generations along to food. And so now people are cooking more, talking about food more, going out more, buying more gizmos and gadgets. And, and she was all for that. She just wanted people to enjoy food. And so I think she'd have very mixed feelings.
Right. Do you think that maybe she would feel that some folks have dealt with food or in the whole culture and atmosphere around eating now that is so popular and thinking that it's almost become too precious in a way?
Could be. I mean, I'd hate to put words in her mouth, but, you know, she was about making food delicious and fun, and she had this very optimistic worldview. She didn't like people who were too concerned about fat, for example. She would call them the fat police, and she would encourage you to eat more butter and more cream.
So there were no vegans.
In moderation.
No vegans.
Yeah, yeah. She didn't like macrobiotics. She didn't like vegetarians. She didn't like nutritionists, or at least that's what she said. I think partly for that she would say these kind of somewhat inflammatory things to kind of stir up the pot and get the conversation going, because the more people talked about food, the more they cared about it. And so she was, you know, intentionally provocative at times. But I don't know. I think she, as long as people were actually cooking and not just talking about it, I think she would be all in favor.
You know, I have a little bit of tape here from her show from when it began in 1963. And, of course, the episode was about beef bourguignon. And I may be butchering the French pronunciation here. How do you say it, Alex?
It's bœuf bourguignon.
Oh, bœuf bourguignon. There, how do
Which
I,
really means just beef stew.
Okay, great.
It sounds fancy, but it's not.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of tape here of how Julia opened that very first episode of her show.
Hello, I'm Julia Child. Welcome to The French Chef and the first show on our series on French cooking. We're going to make bœuf bourguignon, beef stew, and red wine. And it's a wonderful show to begin our series on because it shows you so many useful things about French cooking.
Now, as your book explains, Alex, this was what you call a second act for her. She was, I believe, about 50 years old at the time when she started mm-hmm. this show. Where
yep.
do you think she got the confidence to do this?
Well, Julia described herself as a ham, so she did like to perform. She was very self-confident, although modest as a person. And I think it came from two places. First of all, this natural instinct of hers to be a teacher. She just loved to share her own interest. And that interest was sparked by the food of France, which she just fell in love with. And so she had this, what I think of as her special sauce, where she had spent years in obscurity learning her trade, practicing, making mistakes, doing it over again, making recipes again and again, teaching classes, writing the first book, which was Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which came out in 1961 with her French colleagues. And so she had this great expertise combined with this wonderfully humorous, charismatic, funny, provocative personality. And it was just a winning combination.
Okay, I want to remind listeners that you can weigh in here on this conversation. We're talking about TV and Cambridge icon Julia Child, her life and her recipes, particularly this Thanksgiving week. Are there any Julia Child recipes making it onto your Thanksgiving dinner table? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Melissa is calling from Newton. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi. So in 1970, I was trying to cook one of her recipes, baking bread, and I lived in Waltham, and I couldn't figure out how to get the bricks in the oven correctly. So it was the old days. I looked in the phone book. She was listed. I called her up. She explained how to set up the bricks and wished me good luck. And my bread came out great.
Oh, that's terrific. You know, there are many stories. I think I read a Boston Globe story about her where she was called the National Thanksgiving Commander-in-Chief. Alex Prudhomme, was this really? Did she always take phone calls all the time to help people?
Yeah,
with
I was actually standing in her kitchen on several occasions when the phone would ring and she would spend a good 10 or 15 minutes coaxing people through. I have a funny story about Thanksgiving, which is that my parents lived in rural Connecticut on a windy backcountry road, and Julia had a terrible sense of direction. And one Thanksgiving, she and her husband Paul came to visit, and of course they got lost. And our neighbor was in her house, and the turkey wasn't going well. And she said, "Well, if only Julia Child would stop by." At which point, she heard a knock on the door, opened the door, and looked up to see this 6-foot-2 woman being Julia, and practically fell over. And Julia said, "Do you know where the Prudhommes live?" And she said, "Yes, I'll tell you, but if you help me with my turkey." And so Julia proceeded to help her with the turkey, and she said, "Oh, they're just down the road." She's still telling that story.
Well, we have some more stories, more remembrances from Cambridge, but this is actually from a woman in Marblehead. Now, Rebecca, you're calling from Marblehead. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I was calling with a similar story, actually. My family lore is that my aunt was a recent college graduate in the early 70s, nannying around Boston and sort of figuring out what to do with her life. Also looked Julia Child up in the phone book and was invited to lunch. So went that moment to lunch with Julia Child at her house. And then sort of Julia Child made some connections with her in Paris, and she'd been a college French major, and she went to Paris, learned to cook, was a chef, and sort of put her on her life track.
Wow. Any recipes that you have that maybe your aunt makes now from Julia Child?
I would say my aunt is the family chef. I'm the eater.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thanks very much for calling. Julie is calling from Wakefield. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I remember as a teenager watching Julia Child, my mother and I, and my mother was a fabulous cook as well. And it was just so wonderful to watch her because Julia was so real. She had such a marvelous sense of humor. She could touch the food, which many people just don't do anymore. You learned so much, and yet, in a way, it was almost not everyday cooking, but cooking that any person could do in their own kitchen. She was wonderful to watch. It was just a terrific show.
All right. Julie, thanks so much for sharing. You know, we do have to talk about some Thanksgiving things because she was well known for that reconstructed turkey recipe, which I have to say, Alex, I'm incredibly intimidated every time I see her do that. I mean, would you say that that was a Thanksgiving staple? And did you ever have Thanksgiving with her? What was it like?
Oh, yeah. We had Thanksgiving together. Julia was my great aunt, so, you know, she was a member of the family, and she would either come to my parents or we would go up to Cambridge. And she liked to make a very rich, creamy pumpkin soup that she would serve in an actual pumpkin. You know, the thing about Julia that I think that Julie touched on when she says that, you know, Julia touched the food, That's one of the things that really inspired her audience. She was constantly tasting and touching and, you know, whether she was slapping a turkey around or talking about how neurotic potatoes are or just constantly, you know, massaging butter into chickens. She just was very tactile and very sensory. And that was something that people hadn't seen on television before. I mean, my favorite one is there were two. One is there was a dessert that was falling apart. So she took her long fingers and just kind of smushed it together. And she said, oh, it'll taste better that way.
I actually think we have a piece of tape from that. That was from the 1971 episode of The French Chef where she's making that upside down apple.
Oh, well, that's a different one. But yeah, that's a great one. Tarte Tatin. Yeah,
Tarte Tatin. You're much better than I am here. Let's listen to this clip.
So this goes out onto the platter. That unrolled it very badly. But I'll just have to show you that it's not going to make too much difference because it's all going to fix up. But this is going to be... I think this is the kind of thing you have to expect, even if you have guests peering at you in the kitchen, because you can show how clever you are by fixing everything up.
Alex Prudhomme, Julia Child's great nephew. Julia showing us there how clever she is because she could fix everything up, even mistakes in the kitchen. But I wonder what that sort of self-deprecating tone that she took, what do you think that did for her?
Well, it brought her down to earth. I mean, her audience would call her Julia in the first person as if they knew her well. And in a sense, they did. As I said, she was very much that way in real life. And you can hear her kind of laughing at herself as she's messing around. A tarte tatin is a beautiful, it's pretty easy, but it's a beautiful caramelized apple dessert that you flip over, kind of like a pineapple upside down cake. And in that clip, she's flipped it over, and instead of this beautiful caramel dome, what you see is a pile of beige mush. And so she ends up just sprinkling some sugar over it, running it under the broiler, and saying, oh, look at that, you know, you fixed it all up. You could show your friends how clever you are. And the thing that I love about that story is years later, when she and I were working on her memoir together, she was still mad about that tarte tatin. She was a closet perfectionist, and... she didn't like to seem unprofessional, and so she would mutter kind of conspiratorially that someone must have mislabeled the apples as if they had done it on purpose to her. But but what's great about that clip is it was a learning moment where she showed you, look, even the great Julia Child makes mistakes, and you have to learn to expect it and, you know, never apologize, but, you know, make the best of it.
All right.
It was a great moment.
Okay, great. Yeah. I want to get some more callers in here. Joan is calling from West Yarmouth. Joan, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was working at WGBH when Julia was there, and I met her. My mother actually was a friend of her. Ruth Lockwood. She was her director, I guess. One time I was watching her on her show. And she dropped a piece of meat. I don't know whether it was a chicken or a lamb or something, but she dropped it on the floor, picked it up, and dusted it off, and went on cooking with it.
Oh. Well, I think I know that at one point NPR said that Julia told NPR, NPR said that Julia Child told them that she had never dropped a chicken.
That's what she told me. I there's many stories about her dropping a turkey or a fish or whatever. She said to me she'd never dropped anything like that. The one that she did do, which you may have seen recreated in the movie Julie and Julia, was she was making a potato pancake and it flipped out of the pan onto the stove. And she said, well, if you're alone in the kitchen, who's to know? And she just scooped it back up and put it back in. But she was, again, she was very professional and she was very experienced. And you know, she wouldn't drop a steak on the floor and dust it off. I don't think that would ever happen.
I see. Let's go back to Thanksgiving menu here because we started with pumpkin soup in the pumpkin. Tarte Tatin, right, was also a classic for her. But she also had a pumpkin pie recipe that I'm told she said could not be altered, even though she was somewhat of a creative cook herself. What else might be on a Julia Child Thanksgiving table, Alex?
Oh, we might have several different kinds of cranberry sauce, a cranberry relish, always handmade. We would have stuffing with oysters in it, very rich, fantastic. That always went very quickly. Usually a scalloped potatoes and cream or maybe leeks. And, of course, a magnificent bird.
All right. Well, it sounds great. Alex Prudhomme, Julia Child's great nephew. He's the co-author of her memoir, My Life in France, and author of the new book, The French Chef in America, Julia Child's Second Act. There's more information about the book and some recipes at our website, radioboston.org. Alex Prudhomme, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Deborah. Happy Thanksgiving and bon appetit, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.